Bonjour et bienvenue à la balado-diffusion du colloque « Éthique des médias, de l'information au marché » tenu à Montréal en avril 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast of the Media Ethics from Information to Markets Conference that took place in Montreal in April 2009.
Richard is a professor of journalism and a chair of the Human Research Ethics Committee at the University of South Australia, Adelaide. He's a former newspaper journalist and is also the director of the university's postgraduate journalism program. His research interest is journalism ethics, and he has published widely in this field. He is closely involved with the Ethics Centre of South Australia, which fosters collaborative research and scholarships in ethics. Since 2003, he has been director of Australian Journalism Review, and Australian's leading refereed journal in the academic field of journalism.
So thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you all for inviting me here. It is strange. I think this is the first time I've been to a conference where I'm the only person without an accent. So, now, Australia has many advantages. It's a wonderful country, but it does have some deficiencies. One of those is that it's monocultural. So I'm afraid that I can't speak French, so this will be in English. So my apologies to those of you who are... I don't think we have any mono-French speakers, but those of you to the French speakers. And my apologies, too, if I repeat some of the information which has already been discussed in French, because I didn't pick up everything that has been said in the last 2 days. What I'd like to do, though, is to start really by just asking you to cast your minds back to the little earlier this year, to Saturday, February the 7th. Now, I have no doubt that Montreal was snowing, probably ice and snow everywhere, the sort of weather that we never don't get anywhere in Australia. Back where I am, at home in Australia, though, it was a hot and very threatening day for us. Right across southeastern Australia. We'd just had an intense summer heat wave for a number of days. Hot air had come down from the deserts of central Australia, and the temperatures were regularly in the high 30s and low 40s. A cold front was sweeping in from the Indian Ocean, but like most cold fronts after such intense heat, it was accompanied by strong gusts of wind, which reached gale force. The change meant welcome relief to most of us, but it also meant an increased risk of fire. Anything that caught a light would be blown by this wind across vegetation and would ignite, because everything was extremely dry after the heat. And as my introduction made clear, I live and work in the city of Adelaide on the southern coast of Australia. It's a city of about 1.2 million between the ocean and the sea, and we have a low range of hills behind us, which known as the Adelaide Hills, which are covered in thick vegetation. Of course, people get very nervous when this weather event happens because of the threat of bushfire, what we call bushfires, what I think Americans call forest fires or wildfires. And Canadians too, I guess, that call them wildfires. This time we were fortunate because the hills behind Adelaide did not ignite, but the neighbouring state of Victoria was not so lucky. And as the world was soon to learn, February the 7th, 2009, came to be known as Black Saturday. Was the day when the worst bushfires we've ever had in Australia since white settlement erupted. By the time they were extinguished, By the time the fires went out several days later, almost 200 lives had been lost. There were more than 100 people had been injured. Almost 2,000 houses destroyed, 8,000 people homeless, and millions of hectares of bushland had been destroyed. Not surprisingly, this was the major news story for many days. There was extensive and, in many cases, excellent reporting of the fires, the victims, the survivors, and so on. Some idea of what it was like can be gained from this report, which I'll just take the liberty if it comes up. We watch our home, our lives, everything we own, blazing fiercely just metres away. The heat builds, we try to drive down our driveway, but fallen branches block the way. I reverse back towards the house, but my wife warns me about streets of hot, red-hot roofing metal blowing towards us. I drive back down, pushing the car through the branches. Further down the 400-metre drive, the flames have passed, but at the bottom, trees are burning. We sit in the open, motor running and air conditioner turned on full. Behind us, our home is aflame. That was written by Gary Hughes, a senior journalist with the Australian newspaper, whose home, in fact, was destroyed during the fires. He and his family had a very narrow escape. They almost lost their lives, but they didn't. They survived. Now, Gary wrote a number of pieces about his experience, which were picked up and a lot of them were relayed around the world and published elsewhere. This was the good media at work, as I would call it. Other examples of the good media at work around this event were the role played by the ABC, our ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, they put on one of their local stations, they converted to a local emergency network for people to warn them of the fires, what was happening, let them know if their houses were threatened and so on. ABC local radio decided to postpone programs to relay up to the minute news of the fire, so that was a different strand. That wasn't for that was the first one, dot point is for the people fighting the fires, the second one is for ordinary people. Who are citizens, and the third one was saturation coverage, which led to a massive public response. There was massive sympathy for the victims and a massive amount of support followed on from that. However, as might be expected, all was not sweetness and light. Invariably, there were some examples of what we might call bad media. There were reports which portrayed some of those who died in ways in which in such a way that they could be easily identified, in some cases before their relatives were even aware that they'd died. There were reporters who ignored police restrictions and entered burnt-out areas. Some of these, there was conjecture as to how the fire started. In some cases it was by lightning, but in other cases there were arsonists, lunatics, as I'd call them, who'd lit fires, pyromaniacs, whatever you like to call them. Okay, I'll leave that. I'll just continue. So what it really meant was that the police, these were crime areas. They were cordoned off by the police and no one was supposed to enter, but a number of reporters actually sneaked around behind the police lines and got into the area so they could do their reporting. There were some reporters whose behaviour was rude, abrupt, whatever you might have liked to describe, but they were desperate to get their stories and so they antagonised the local people who'd been through the fires. And in other words, they provoked anger and hostility. And others invaded the grief of people who were shocked and bewildered. Thanks, Dominic. And I'll just read out one of the complaints from one of the, just as an example of a complaint. There was a resident from the village of Kinglake, who actually said one of the commercial, if you could see the overhead, one of the commercial television stations landed a helicopter in the middle of a fire area and just went straight up to the people who were grieving. She just went up and asked them about it straight away. You know, they wanted the tears and in the process caused great distress, but they just wanted a film of people crying. So that was an example of the sort of behaviour that followed. Now, the combination of good media and bad media, which was represented by the coverage of the fires, is hardly unique. Similar performances are common in news coverage around the world in most situations, and perhaps especially when there are traumatic events such as disasters involved. But I think what was different this time, meaning the time of the Victorian fires, is the background against which it was taking place. As we know, the traditional news media are under siege. Global financial crisis, challenges from the internet and so on, I won't go into all that, I'm sure we're all aware of those. But as in Australia alone, in the past year, just as an indication of the problems facing the media, we've witnessed the closure of the oldest major weekly news magazine, The Bulletin, which went for over 150 years. The axing of two very high-quality current affairs programs, one called Sunday and one called Nightline. The laying off of 120 journalists by John Fairfax and Sons, who... You're going well, Dominic. John Fairfax and Sons, who are the publishers of the quality broadsheets, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and the Australian Financial Review. And the last we have there are only two cities left in Australia which have more than one daily newspaper. That's Sydney and Melbourne. And those two each have two daily newspapers, and those newspapers are locked in a fight to the commercial death. They're really, their circulations are not going well, but I'm sure you've experienced the same thing here. So overall, as far as I can see, the thanks, Dominic, traditional news media are facing facing the strongest threat that they've faced, certainly in my lifetime. And common responses in Australia have been similar to, from talking to people here, as I gather, in people have responses in Canada. News organisations have cut editorial costs to the bone. They've sacked journalists, tried to move online to save their circulation and printing costs, and indeed some have closed down. Now, many consequences flow from this situation, but the one that concerns me, of course, is the pressure on ethical standards and what it means for journalism ethics. Trying to explain the behaviour of those journalists who performed poorly during the Black Sunday bushfires, the ones I referred to earlier, is I think, quite difficult to do. There are obvious practical considerations. It's not easy to report from those situations. We understand that. It's not... people are tired, exhausted. No one knows what's going on. There are reasons that individual journalists might put forward for why they, for example, went behind a police line. I guess the point I would make is that's not an adequate explanation for that sort of behaviour. As we also know, there are a number of reasons for unethical behaviour in journalism. I'm not going to go through them all here because I guess people are well aware of what they are, but of what a lot of them are. But the one that I think in this case was the most significant force at work was raised by the former editor of the Melbourne Age, Michael Gawenda, who's no longer the editor. But a few days after the fire, he wrote the following, and I think this will come up now. Journalists and media executives are not ordinary people. They have a range of motivations when it comes to covering a major disaster like this. Journalists want to get the best stories. Editors and executive producers want to beat their competitors. They all know that a disaster like this is not just a shocking and grief-producing event, but an opportunity. They know that their ratings will climb through the roof and newspaper circulations will spike. We also hope they know and understand that their role in communal grieving and solidarity, understand their role in communal grieving and solidarity, but that's not, in my experience, a major consideration. All right. We also hope they know and understand their role in communal grieving and solidarity, but that's not, in my experience, okay, major consideration. All right. So, in other words, it's all about ratings and circulation, commercial competition, market forces. The traditional media business model at work, in other words. The media gather their audiences and sell those audiences to advertisers. Advertisers go where the eyeballs go, so those outlets with the greatest circulation and ratings collect the largest audience and hence receive the greatest return from their advertisers. This is market forces at work, although it may be worth pointing out that market forces in themselves are neither ethical nor unethical, by which I mean they make no moral judgments about the commodities to which they apply. Market forces operate in the same way with regard to trade in sugar or oranges as they do for trade in heroin or child pornography. In regard to journalism, they make no moral judgment about the content, form or presentation of the news. But as Michael Gawenda's comments suggest, they undermine ethical journalism because they exert an irresistible pressure on journalism to justify its existence in economic terms and to maximise the financial returns. And one way of doing this is to be first with the news, regardless of the consequences. However, given the current position in which the traditional media finds itself, such behaviour seems unwise, to say the least. Faced with declining profits, it seems obvious to me that the media organisations and the journalists who work for them should be doing all they can to maintain grace and favour with their readers, listeners and viewers. Yet, as sections of the Australian media indicated during the Black Saturday bushfires, behaviour which upsets and antagonises readers and viewers continues to occur with almost monotonous regularity. Unethical behaviour in such situations is highly visible to the wider population, and it's hardly surprising that there have been strong reactions of contempt and cynicism from many readers and viewers. As such, this is extremely damaging because it appears to accelerate the movement of audiences to alternative news sources. In other words, in this way, that sort of journalistic behaviour is undermining the economic position of traditional media organisations and undermining their claims to perform any public service role. At the same time, it seems that many commercial media organisations are locked into a fight to commercial death, desperately trying to outlast their rivals as advertising revenue declines and moves elsewhere. In this situation, surely it would be far more logical to work together, to combine forces, to cooperate against the common enemy, which is threatening the existence of all. The obvious question is why? Why do so many journalists and media organisations continue to behave in ways which appear to undermine their long-term interests? To answer this question is not simple. There are many complex forces at work, but one which I think deserves more attention than it has generally received is the fact that in Australia, and I believe in most other countries, most media organisations are today in the hands of senior managers who have been trained in management rather than in the practice of journalism. In my view, there is a problem with what is taught in management programs and training courses. Yet the content of these courses shapes the attitudes of students and often continues to influence them long after graduation. These attitudes are not necessarily conducive to the ethical practice of journalism and not necessarily helpful in the crisis in which journalism finds itself. Okay, so let's look at some common elements in the view of the world as shaped by management theory and management courses. Stakeholder theory is a common... I'll put these up now. Stakeholder theory is a commonly component of these courses, and it is useful in many ways. Yes, it is. However, it's not without its problems for journalism. Treating journalists as stakeholders can lock them into a special relationship with a particular organisation or a particular section of society, in the process eroding their ability to perform a watchdog role in relation to that organisation or group, and also undermining their responsibility to represent the broader interests of society. The interpretation of capitalism, commonly taught, assumes that market participants are motivated by self-interest, that morality is separate from prosperity, and that competition for limited resources is the dominant mode of prosperity. Competition, is necessary, it is argued, due to many individuals fighting over the same resources. Other individuals are seen as a threat to survival rather than as potential partners for value creation. Capitalists are left with the problem of resolving competitor demands and threats. This view incorporates a strong strand of survival of the fittest theory, often interpreted as the view that competition is the best way to proceed, that it sorts the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. It allows the best and most efficient organisations to survive. Underlying all this is the positioning of ethics, and in this respect I found it, within these courses I mean, in this respect I found it particularly enlightening to read a recent paper by the late Sumantra Ghoshal. Some of you may be aware of this, of Ghoshal's work, but if not, this thing works. Yes, that's the reference. At the time of his death in 2006, Ghoshal was Professor of Strategic and International Management at the London Business School, a member of the Committee of Overseers at Harvard Business School, and co-author of a book nominated by London's Financial Times newspaper as one of the 50 most influential management books. In the paper, Ghoshal presents a devastating critique of what is taught in business schools. He argues that many of the worst excesses of management have their roots in a set of ideas that emerged from business school academics over the past 30 years. Briefly, he argues that attempts to make business studies a science have led to the dominance of a research-oriented model of management, and that a direct consequence of this process has been the explicit denial of any role for moral or ethical considerations in the practice of management. Instead, most of the disciplines in which management theories are rooted have been penetrated by an ideology which is essentially grounded in a set of pessimistic assumptions about both individuals and institutions. Ethics does not fit easily into this frame, being viewed largely as an individual concern which should be excluded from social theory. Since the paper was published, many others have come out in agreement. And just as one example, I'll quote the Freeman et al. Last year wrote, the problem of business ethics is that ethics is left out from the story of capitalism. Rather than acknowledging the moral dimensions of every decision, whether in business or not, academics and practitioners have created a separate sphere of norms, rules and morals and named it capitalism, where competition and winning dictate the rules of the game. One of the consequences of all this is that individuals who have been trained in management or management theory have limited understandings of business ethics and even less of the ethical practice of journalism. It's not that they are intentionally unethical or anti-journalism, but rather that fundamental journalistic values often suffer a form of collateral damage from the drive to run an efficient business. A further consequence is that the notion of cooperation gets a poor hearing. Managers tend to assume that business is all about competing to survive, not working together to survive, even though the story of capitalism is not complete, without acknowledging many examples of collaboration and mutually beneficial relationships. Indeed, it's been urged by some scholars that strong collaborative relationships are necessary for many entrepreneurial ventures. All of this has implications for the current crisis facing journalism, when, to put it in basic terms, it seems increasingly that the need is for more cooperation rather than fighting one's competitors to commercial death. All right, well, in conclusion then, I'll finish off now. In conclusion, it's important to remember that underlying the media's current troubles is the role of journalism in democratic government. What the current crisis could mean for this role has been spelled out elsewhere, and I won't go into it in any detail, but it revolves around what the Australian editor and publisher Eric Beecher has called public trust journalism. By this, he means the type of journalism. Well, public trust journalism, the type of journalism which criticises, scrutinises and calls different sections of society to account. It seems obvious that any society should support what is best for its citizens overall. And there seems little doubt that what is best for a democratic society is a free press which carries this type of journalism. But if the news media are to serve rather than damage democracy, then they need to maintain and adhere to basic ethical standards. The traditional media, and especially newspapers, employ the bulk of the reporters in the Western world, and in most cases they are expected, I'm not saying they always do, but they are expected to write clearly, adhere to ethical codes of conduct, and conduct themselves professionally. We're all aware of the competition from the internet and the plethora of online outlets for journalism, which are breaking down the dominance of the big media companies, but as we heard from Chris yesterday, we have yet to find a way of maintaining ethical standards for online journalism. And the idea that blogs and citizen journalism will usher in some kind of new golden era in journalism as it subsumes traditional news platforms seems a little unrealistic. For the fact is that writing regular, high quality and grammatically correct text to a deadline requires discipline. It's difficult to do, harder to do well for an extended period, and even harder without a strong revenue stream. The fragmentation of the audience facilitated by the internet makes this even more difficult. For these reasons, there's a strong case to support the traditional media, although just how this should be done remains unclear. To find the answers requires extensive public discussion and debate, and it's in the media's own interests to be the responsible partners in this discussion and debate. This process is not helped by unethical journalism or by the intensely competitive approach adopted by most commercial media. This undermines public support for the media and has undesirable commercial and social consequences. In Australia, there have been a number of occasions when, despite their deep rivalries, the main media players have worked together. The most recent example is the formation of a coalition of major media companies and public broadcasters to form a group called Australia's Right to Know, which basically was formed to fight government attempts to restrict media through changes in privacy legislation. So the point is they can do it. There's no trying to say they should all hold hands and play with each other very nicely, but the point is that they should be less aggressively competitive than they are now. In other words, the time for something much deeper and wider, genuine cooperation and collaboration to confront the current crisis facing journalism has finally arrived. Thank you.
The problem that you were talking about in terms of the way in which the media as an institution or as a collection of organizations depends on the public trust, and yet they keep abusing the public trust. It seems to me it has the structure of what we would call a sort of a classic social dilemma. Right. This is the reason there are no cod left in the North Atlantic, and the reason the environment's getting polluted is that everybody benefits. Everybody in the group, in this case, it's the media organizations, benefits from this public good, right? From this thing that they all rely on, which is the public trust. Yet each of them, as an individual organization, can benefit in the short run from wasting a little bit of that resource, right? And these sorts of problems are notoriously hard to solve. precisely because there's short-term gain to be made from ruining, from doing just a little bit more to ruin a long-term resource. And the way, these are notoriously hard to solve in all kinds of domains, and sometimes they require authoritarian, external, the interference of government, which we would worry about if it were, most of us like some public news, supportive news, but we wouldn't want presumably all of it. I mean, there's only so much you can do to impinge on the freedom of the press. And so it seems like, as times get, this is more like a way of framing the problem rather than really a question. I'm not sure how to turn it into a question. Maybe Daniel's going to help me. But that's... on the one hand, that engenders a kind of cynicism, but on the other hand, it means that it's of a kind with a range of other kinds of social problems that are reasonably well theorized, even if it generates a certain amount of cynicism about how to resolve them. I should have a question at the end of that,
I think that one of the problems is that I'm uncertain at the end of the day that everybody likes cod. What I mean by that is that it's not that there is one public that is kind of conflicted. Well, we want the highest standards, but sometimes we want a little bit of the sort of saucy stuff as well. I lived in England for 4 years, where I don't think there's a country in the world where the cleavage between the gutter press and the high-end press is as deep and as broad. I mean, The Sun, which is the by far, by an order of magnitude, the most widely read newspaper in, or I shouldn't say read, the most widely flipped through newspaper in Britain. I mean, Journal de Montréal, is like... This is gutter. We don't know. We don't see the gutter. They have.
You mentioned the word cleavage, and that's what it's all about.
I didn't use the word with the pun in mind, but I'm kind of happy that I did now. So it's not that the Sun readers out there are, and the Independent and Times and Sunday and Telegraph readers are. They're not in the same space. So it's not clear to me that there's anything that is being, we'll put it this way, it doesn't seem to me that if we shut down the Sun, we would get a whole bunch more Telegraph and Independent readers. And so I sort of wonder, this leads me back to attention in your paper. You sort of said on the one hand, all these, when there were the fires, all these unscrupulous reporters, there were the good ones, but then there were all these unscrupulous people going in and taking pictures. And on the one hand, you said they depleted the public trust, but on the other hand, you also said that the reason that they were doing it is because their sales figures went through the roof, right? So what is happening is that you have, clearly the two can't be, unless there are schizophrenics out there, the two can't be right at the same time. They're the Sun readers, or the equivalent in Australia of the Sun, who are very happy and unconflicted in having pictures of crying people. And then you have this other and numerically smaller group of people whose trust is being eroded. But if at the end of the day you're looking at the bottom line, it's not clear that you should prioritize the sort of moral scruples of the Independent and Times readers, sort of poo-poo the sort of wishes and desires of the Sun readers. I mean, I don't think the Australian situation is quite as
it's quite as dramatic. But the point is, the figures would have gone through it, circulation figures would have gone through the roof regardless of the intrusion, on the privacy and grief. I mean, without that, it was still the most dramatic story we've had in Australia for years. And I guess I take Chris's point, really it's like the fishermen fish themselves. It's in their own interest. The more fishing they do, you're going to be out of a livelihood, mate, in a couple of years. And in a sense, what I'm saying is the same for certainly the commercial media. I mean, it's self-interest rules supreme with those media. We've all dealt with them. We know that the proprietors and so on, how they operate. But it is in their self-interest to look out for themselves, in other words. So the way they're going now, it's suicidal. Yes, it's like the cod fishermen.
What's interesting about Daniel's question is, to me, is it echoes a phraseology one hears from journalists a lot, which is, we need to do this being some variation of being better journalists or maintaining editorial independence or something. this, in order to maintain the public trust, which is dwindling in newspapers. And you know, I wonder, is there any actual evidence at all that says that people, that people's trust in or desire for to consume journalism is related to the practice of good ethics among journalists?
I mean, it's an excellent question, I have to say, it is. I guess that the evidence, well, I can speak about in the Australian context, would be the demand for the quality publications. There are four, at least four quality, what would be regarded as quality newspapers, and also for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, especially ABC Radio, has a lot of what would be regarded as intellectual programs and also challenging programs, good news and current affairs, a wide range of programs which would perform that role. No, I mean, I suppose the point is that, no, most of the population probably don't really care, but, I mean, there are many things that a majority of the population may not care about. I mean, capital punishment, majority probably would favour that. So the fact that it's only a smaller proportion doesn't actually invalidate the argument, I don't think, no.
Thanks. So at the roundtable last evening, you weren't there, but there are quite a few people said that they actually thought that competition was a really good thing, and there were journalists there, and they said, yeah, in some cases, competition, it's true that it leads to, you know, tabloidism or something like that, but generally speaking, they thought it was a really positive thing. They thought that it actually improves the content and the diversity of the information in media. So do you think that that's sometimes the case? And if so, when is it that competition leads to a degradation of the content? And, you know, are there conditions where it leads to that and other conditions in which it actually improves the content? Is there some kind of principle distinction?
It depends how you define competition, I suppose. I mean, yes, in a broad sense, yes, it does encourage diversity and seeking out different audiences and all those sorts of things. Part of the problem is I assume that people who were speaking last night were practitioners. Is that right? And there's a... I mean, the whole journalistic subculture, I mean, the whole lot of values which go with people are socialised into accepting, and competition being first with the news is probably number one. So I'd find it, I think, well, as a former practitioner, I think in my own experience, when I finally got out of working as a journalist, I started to question these things. When you're working in it, you don't.
They're brainwashed, kind of.
Sorry?
They're brainwashed.
I wouldn't say they're brainwashed. But there are certain values which they accept as, you don't challenge those. And that's one of the key values which you don't challenge as a working journalist.
So good journalism is not the only higher good that we might say one of two things about. Either that it's underproduced, as Chris said, that it's there's a market failure, in which case we know, at least in concept, we know how to deal with it. Or we just think that people don't have the right values, the right preferences, and good luck to us trying to do something about that. Here are some other ones. String quartets, chamber music. People in this town, in most towns, in every town that I know of, would rather watch hockey than go to a concert. It's better for you, Daniel, to go to a string quartet than to go to hockey, but you will go to hockey and not the string quartet. What are we going to do? We could bemoan the fact that poor Daniel doesn't like classical music. Maybe you do. I don't know. Not during the hockey season, right? Okay, it's never in the winter, which is the only time that people are playing quartets. So what are we going to do? So again, one could say, which is probably true, that certain kinds of cultural artifacts are underproduced because they're non-rivalrous in consumption. So museums need to be subsidized by either private or public because obviously the cultural value of it is higher than what any individual person will pay for a ticket. We waver between thinking that, oh, the problem here is this kind of collective action problem and there's a positive externality, we need to subsidize it, or between the view that, oh, if only we were good paternalists, we'd force these people into their concert seats and force these people to read these good newspapers. So I'm not quite sure why this is a, with all sorts of other higher order goods, we basically say, oh, isn't it too bad that most ordinary people don't share our higher order tastes? But when it comes to great journalism, we seem to think that somehow the Republic's going to fall. Now, one possibility is that unlike consumption of string quartets or art and museum, it's personally elevating to the person who goes and therefore the person who doesn't go is failing in some respect to cultivate the higher pleasures, but it doesn't have a systemic negative spillover effect on the rest of us. And we might think that our fellow citizens have a duty to us to read Tony high-end journalism so they can be better citizens and go vote. Is that the argument that you're offering?
I think there is an analogy with art galleries and museums. Yes, I do. I think the people who want to read The Sun, I mean, fine, if they want to go and read The Sun, I don't think you stop them reading The Sun, and The Sun can produce whatever they want for that audience. But the point is that the conventional or the traditional role of journalism, we all know what that is, and I think it performs a vital function in society. So, yes, I go to the Australian example because that's the one I know best. The ABC has had, yes, governments try and control it. Yes, they do. There's a lot of manipulation, appointments to the board, all those sorts of things which politicians get up to. We all know that. Despite that, though, it has actually worked extremely well. It's very critical of the government. It's different sections of it are. Different governments have tried to control it. The funding is on a three-year basis. Every 3 years they... And governments have tried to cut their budget and do all sorts of things to them. But despite all that, it is a central strand in Australian democracy. It plays a vital role, its cultural role, yes, but also a social role. And in terms of Australian democracy, it plays a vital role.
When it comes to museums, we don't bemoan the fact that some people go to Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. I mean, Do we consider it to be a public policy problem? We have to try to suppress, come up with strategies to keep people from going to the wax museum?
No, we have strategies to allow keep it, the sorts of museums you might regard as in a positive light going, that's all. And so in other words, yes, I have no problem with the government subsidy to sections of the media, no.
So what's your question? I mean, it doesn't seem that hard to figure out why there's a difference and why we should care more about whether people are well-informed about the news.
I'm just going to model it. So we care that our neighbors are well informed because it affects us.
We have that view. We might be wrong, but there's this view about the importance of an informed citizen being able to make the right decision. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, then why are we?
We should take stronger measures, which is why
we require
people to
NPR. Yeah. Well, the papers that Judith read, she said yesterday, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they have admitted, they have apologized that part of the reason that, it may not be a republic, but part of the reason the government of Iraq fell is because they weren't doing their jobs, that they did not question the Bush administration in its run-up to the war. My question, Ian, is about concentration and convergence of the media, consolidation. Is the level of that in Australia as great as it is here in Canada? And what effect has that had? You mentioned that almost none of the cities have more than one newspaper, but is it because companies are taking over the newspapers and they're consolidating, or they're just dying out? What is the effect of consolidation on the ethical journalism in Australia?
That's a good question. It's been bemoaned for many years, I think. The collapse of the newspapers is in common with newspapers elsewhere around the world. And the survivors in most cities are Rupert Murdoch's... I have the honour of coming from the city where Murdoch started, is the first newspaper. There is a general view, yes, that it has affected ethical standards, yes, because if there's no competition, what's the matter? They don't have to worry about offending people or the sorts of things that I was talking about. Well, obviously they deny that that's the case, but I think it is the case. However, it has also given an impetus to things like coming back to the example of the ABC or our special broadcasting service, the SBS, which have, there's an audience which they've picked up. In my own city, the ABC radio has just topped the ratings against commercial radio. And people are saying, how can they do that? They're not commercial. They shouldn't, the commercial stations are surprised and puzzled and perplexed by this. But the reason, I think, is primarily because people are turning to them because they're credible and they can trust them. It comes back to credibility and trust, which the some of the other organisations are losing because of the way they've behaved. Yeah. One of the ironies in all this, incidentally, is that Murdoch has been a hate figure for many years, but suddenly now in the last 6 to 12 months he's becoming to be seen as the last great hope of Australian journalism, so, or newspapers anyway, but Andrew might want to say more about that when he talks, but anyway, I won't go on about it. Yeah, sorry. Oh, okay.